We're back in Luke 5, continuing with the Galilean ministry. You'll remember in this chapter so far has been the miracle of the draught of fishes, where Simon Peter, is called. Then Jesus healed a leper, then a paralytic, and this caused a controversy with the Pharisees, who we were just introduced to in the last section, were questioning Jesus about what he had done. Now we're coming to more controversies with the Pharisees and some more disciples. But in Luke 5:27-39, is all about Levi. Levi is called to be a disciple, and then he has a feast, and this feast engenders some conversation with the Pharisees and some others. It begins in verse 27, and after these things. Well, what does that mean, after these things?
After the previous.
So it's just a chronological marker. And the next thing that happened was, or does it mean something maybe more than that? You'll remember the thing that just happened. He healed the paralytic. The Pharisees said, who can do this? And they have this controversy. And before that, there was the leper. And after these things, so I think what he's trying to say here, this is related to that. This is going to demonstrate part of what he's just been saying about what Jesus did. This is a continuation of that. And so it's related to what has just gone before. So after these things, he went forth and saw a publican named Levi sitting at the receipt of custom. He's a publican. What is a publican? All right. What is a tax collector?
Cheater. Somebody said that the Romans set up to take the money for both Rome, and they can have a substantial part of it. They so cheat.
All right.
They despise that.
Okay. Yeah, the word publican comes from a Latin word, publicani, which was a specific type of tax collector. And even though the Vulgate translated this word publicani and it ended up in English as publican, the system, the publicanus system of taxation had ended in Galilee, in Palestine, before the time of Christ. The word that's translated here is not the word for publican, it's the word for tax collector or toll collector. What these people did, and so often, when we talk about what was going on at that time, you can't just say, this is what these people did, because it depends. Galilee was under a different administration than the rest of Palestine. Galilee taxes went through Antipas. He had control over them. Judea and Jerusalem was under the prefect of Judea and was under more direct Roman control of taxation, whereas Galilee had more independent taxation system with these toll collectors, and the money did not go directly to the Romans. So a tax collector in Judea might be despised because he's directly supporting Rome, whereas a tax collector in Galilee wouldn't face the same kind of problems because he's not directly supporting Rome. And it depends on, again, it depends on the time, because over time these systems changed. It depends on where, because different geographical regions, they had different ways of doing it. These people in Galilee, a toll collector. Now, the way the Romans did it, the way that was even done in Galilee, was called tax farming. Rather than the government collecting taxes and having people go out and do that, they would just sell the rights to do it to the highest bidder. And so people would bid and say, okay, I'll collect the taxes on this, and I can get you X amount of denarii a year. And then whoever bids the most gets the job, and then they get to go collect the toll. And if they could collect more than that, then obviously that's all pure profit. And so there's tremendous incentive to collect more than you paid for it, which means you'll do everything you can to squeeze everything you can out of people. You make more profit. And we're different levels of tax collectors. We're going to meet later on in the story someone who's called a chief tax collector. So there were people who probably are the ones who bid on the right to collect taxes, and then the people who worked for them. both of them called tax collectors, but probably Levi is one of the people who worked for a chief tax collector, because he's sitting at receipt of custom. He's at the toll booth, literally. Not something the tax farmer himself would do, but something that someone works for him would do. And these are tolls. These are not head taxes. This is not like income tax. This is if you're traveling through with goods, you got to pay a tax on them. Or if you bring in so much produce or so much fish, or they're going to charge you for that. He's there at wherever the little office is that they collect these tolls from people. Now, the publicans were not well-liked at all, the tax collectors, for various reasons. Some people think it is because they are considered agents of the Roman government. They're oppressive government agents. And there probably was some of that going on, although, again, not probably in Galilee. Why else might tax collectors be despised? I mean, everybody despises them because they're taking their money, you know. Nobody who comes and takes your money from you is going to be particularly well-liked. What else about them would make them disliked, unacceptable?
They would take more than was really right for them to take from people.
Okay, yeah, the whole system was set up to create an incentive for me to cheat, to try to charge you more than I should, because as much as I can get you to pay, once I've made enough to cover my cost of buying the rights, then it's all profit. They were really despised because they were just considered all cheats. The Pharisees, the rabbis, had certain occupations that were considered unclean, occupations that were considered sinful, and that people who were in them were just wicked people and beyond the pale of salvation. Generally, kind of four groups that they mentioned that would not pass the test. The first group are donkey drivers, camel drivers, shippers, wagoneers, shepherds, shopkeepers, physicians, and butchers. They were despised because they were in danger of being dishonest. They were in professions where it was considered easy to be dishonest. You know, physicians, we think of physicians, we think of Luke the physician, he was a respected gentleman. They were hated too. They were at the bottom of the barrel too. They were wretched people because they were just considered, one thing, frauds. They were quacks. They didn't know what they were doing back then, and so people didn't usually get healed, and then they got charged a lot of money for it. So physicians had a really bad name back then. The second group are dung collectors, copper smelters, and tanners, all just because of the disgusting nature of what they do made them unclean. The third group are goldsmiths, flax combers, millstone cutters, peddlers, tailors, barbers, bath attendants, bloodletters, and laundrymen. Why do you think they might be despised? What about those occupations made you more than likely unclean?
Someone
had
washed the unclean garments.
Okay. The thing that made these unclean is because they more than likely brought a man into contact with women. Men didn't interact with women, and these are jobs where they would have to talk to women, and that was
apparently not very good to be with.
Right, it was an occupation that would cause you to come into contact with women. You would probably end up unclean because of it. Those professions were out.
Really makes me feel great.
And the last group are dice players, usurers, managers of pigeon races, dealers in Sabbath year produce, shepherds, tax collectors, and toll collectors. And that's because they were just considered dishonest all the time. They lost some of their civil rights. They could not testify in trials because it was just assumed that they would lie about whatever. Toll collectors were near the bottom of the barrel for several different reasons. They were not liked. So that's the kind of person this is, a very low status individual named Levi. This is the only appearance of Levi in the book. And he's sitting at the receipt of customs. He's at the toll booth, wherever that is, somewhere in Galilee, probably along a trade route. And Jesus says to him, "Follow me." That's the only thing that's recorded that he says to Levi, "Just follow me." And Levi's response is, "And he left all, rose up, and followed him." Three things we're told that he did. What is unusual about the order of what he did?
Well, it doesn't make mention of him being anywhere near the other miracles. When he said, follow me, it's kind of in the dark. Wise enough to leave it all, wasn't it?
Well, and that's a good question. He doesn't tell us that he had had any previous contact with Jesus. Now, if the fame of Jesus had gone out as much as they say, and he's still in that area, it'd be hard to believe that he didn't know who he was. But, you know, the same thing happened with Peter. Some of the Gospels accounts, it makes it sound like Peter is just one day fishing, and he comes along and says, follow me, and he walks away. Whereas in Luke, we find out that they had previous contact, that he had healed Peter's mother-in-law, and there is some previous contact. And it's likely here, Levi certainly would have known who he was, so it's not like some stranger just walked up to him and said, follow me. And he said, wow, I'm so overwhelmed by your presence, I'm leaving now. He probably knew exactly what he was getting into. But what about this response of his? What about the order is odd?
We would say that we got up and left everything and followed. And here it says he left everything and got up.
Right. The order seems a little odd. We would say he got up, left everything, and followed Jesus. This literally says he abandoned everything and then stood up. Okay, what does that mean?
In his heart, in his mind, he gave it up.
Yeah, it's probably more of an internal thing. The abandoning isn't just that he walked away from it, even though he's going to do that. It's that he gave it up in his heart. He abandoned that thing that he had done.
Talking sometime before.
Yeah. Probably did. And so he leaves everything. He abandons everything. You might consider this like he's changing his values. What he valued before, what he thought was important before, that all changes now. And so because of that, he gets up and follows Jesus. Certainly was a change in his values. The things that he may have thought before were more important. I heard one person describe it as it's like a department store where somebody went in and changed all the price tags, switched all the price tags during the night, where the things that used to be cheap have very high prices on them. The things that are very valuable have low prices. And that people's values are messed up. Things that should be important and valuable in their lives, they think are unimportant. And things that should be really a big part of their life and very valuable, people don't value. And that part of what Jesus does, part of what repentance is revaluing things. Going back and saying, wait a minute, that wasn't really all that important after all. Why was I spending so much time and effort and money on that, when there was this other thing I should be doing that I didn't pay any attention to, which is so much more valuable? Reordering of values that takes place here for Levi. He abandons what used to be important to him. And even today, we fall into this mindset. If I say to you, just in general, we're talking about somebody, and I say to you, he's very successful. What does that mean? What are you going to think I'm saying?
He's got money.
He's got money. He's a successful businessman. Means he's made a lot of money. It doesn't mean that he's ethical. It doesn't mean that he's particularly charitable. It means he's made a lot of money. He may be a dirtbag, but he's made a lot of money, therefore he's successful. And we kind of buy into that when we call people successful.
Yeah, we need to reevaluate what we think is successful.
Right. Some people may be honest, decent, ethical, charitable business people, and they don't make a lot of money. Okay, so which one is really successful from our point of view? The one who made the most money?
No.
But we do fall into that mindset of saying, well, he's very successful. What do you mean by success when you say that? And Levi here would have been, at least in his mind, in one way, financially, successful. But in every other way, he wasn't. So anyway, we're told in verse 29 that Levi made him a great feast in his own house. And there was a great company of publicans and of others that sat down with him. He left all, and now he's having a feast at his own house. How does that work exactly? He is either, when they say left all, didn't literally mean he left everything because he's got a house, or this is kind of like a going away party. I'm leaving now, having all of my tax collector friends come in. We're going to have a party, a going away celebration. You know, did he keep his house? Probably not permanently, because he's going to be spending the next couple of years wandering around with Jesus, so whether he kept his house or not. Some Christians had houses. We know that. We read later on in Acts. But their attitudes towards them changed. They abandoned them in the sense of, this is no longer my house. This is the Lord's house. This is the church's house. People want to stay here, they can stay here. People want to meet here, they can meet here. It doesn't necessarily mean that they gave everything up and walked away from everything, even though that did happen. It more is a total change in values and in understanding of what things are. And there's going to be one part where he's talking to the disciples, and the disciples say to him, Master, we left everything. And then they name what it is that they left. We left our families, we left our homes, we left all of that behind for you. They're clearly specifying that they did leave all of that, including their families behind. They just got up and walked off with him, quite literally. But there's this great feast and a great company. Luke emphasizing for us, this is a very big party with a lot of people. And they're publicans and others. Who the others are, we don't know, but the Pharisees are certainly going to tell us what they think of them. And they all sat down together. So this is the scene that we've got. Levi, who's just been called, is having a great feast with all these other toll collectors and other people with them. Well, Luke has a lot to say about these kind of dinner parties. They were well known in the ancient world. This they were called symposiums. And people would come, and you eat, and then you recline at the table, kind of on a couch, and you're reclining. We sit at the table. They laid at the table. And you were the guest. And women and servants had to sit at tables. They weren't allowed to lay at them, because that was reserved for men and people of higher stature. In verse 30, but their scribes and Pharisees murmured against his disciples, saying, why do you eat and drink with publicans and sinners? So, first of all, their scribes and Pharisees. Who are their scribes and Pharisees, as opposed to our scribes and Pharisees?
It wasn't that region or that township, wherever he was by.
Okay. Yeah, the people around there, the people in the town. Murmured against the disciples. This is kind of odd. They're not complaining about Jesus being there, even though they're going to do that too later. They're complaining to the disciples about the disciples. They murmured against the disciples, saying, why do ye, plural, why are you disciples eating and drinking with publicans and sinners? Now, the Pharisees are not there. Pharisees wouldn't be caught dead at a party like this because the sinners are there. They're complaining that Jesus is there. They certainly would not have gone to one. So we're supposed to either understand that they're sitting outside or standing outside or just know about it and are complaining to the disciples that he's in this house with these people. And also apparently the disciples too. Some of them or all of them were in there doing the same thing, and they're being complained about. Why do they care? What's the big deal? About what?
It goes against what they believe. Well, the Pharisees were the model of what righteousness is supposed to be like. So they had, like you said before, they had a whole long list of rules and regulations that you cannot do. And probably one of them was eating with publicans and sinners, or even
why would that be one of their rules? What's
because
the problem?
It was against their teachings.
One of the articles that I was reading preparing for this brought up something from a television show that was on years ago called The Wonder Years. It's about these kids growing up in the late 60s, early 70s, and their childhood in suburbia. And one of the first episodes, these kids are just going into junior highs, and it's their first day of junior high, and they're in the lunchroom, and the big decision is, where do I sit? Who do I sit with? The narrator of the show says, in effect, in junior high school, who you are is defined less by who you are than by the person who's sitting next to you at lunch. You are who you sit with. And the Pharisees are essentially saying this to Jesus' disciples. You are who you eat with. And look who you're eating with. Who you ate with was a big deal. It said who you were. It was a sign of kinship and fellowship and bonding to eat with people. It wasn't just like, hey, let's go out for a meal, okay? Eating together was one of the primary forms of of entertainment, of getting together. Most of the clubs that existed, even the funerary societies where people paid club dues to make sure they got buried properly, their events were eating together. They had meals together. And it made a big deal who you ate with. And so for him to eat with these people was to associate with them. To, you know, share a meal with them was a big deal. It said a lot about who they were. And so the Pharisees say, you know, don't you know who you're eating with? You are associating with. You are saying that these people are, you know, my people, my friends. And they're publicans and sinners. Why would you do that? Which tells us something interesting about the Pharisees' view of Jesus, which is what?
If you're eating with publicans and sinners, and they're considered low on the totem pole, you're right amongst them.
Are you? I mean, if they thought he was a sinner, why would they even bother asking the question? Of course he's eating with them. He's one of them.
Well, they did think he was a sinner.
They didn't think he was a sinner. They thought he was righteous. Because otherwise, that's why it didn't make any sense to them. If you remember the last section we looked at, what they said is, we have seen strange things today, or paradoxical things. And so they see Jesus, whom apparently they respect as a rabbi, and think, okay, this guy's got good things to say, and he can do these wonderful things. So why is he eating with these people? It shouldn't be with these people. These are the bad people. We're the good people. It would be like if Jesus Christ were to come back today just to walk among us, and we knew he was here, we'd be like, well, he's going to come here and visit with us. We're his people. He's going to come and see us. And instead, he goes to Five Points and hangs out with people there. We would say, wait a minute. Come on. We've been waiting for you all this time. And we meet and gather together in your name. And we do all these things for you. Why aren't you here with us? Come on. We're having a church fellowship. Come fellowship with us. He said, no, I'd rather go hang out down here with the sinful people. Pharisees were totally confused by that. Why would you hang out with people like that? And perplexed, because at least at this point they don't rank him among them. So they're puzzled why he's eating with them, because it's not the kind of thing you should be doing. And sinners, I mean, what does that mean? There's the publicans, we know who they are. Who are the sinners?
Everybody else but a Pharisee?
Yeah, there are, you know, any number of groups that they would have considered sinners, just anybody who wasn't as pure as they were, who didn't follow the purity laws the way they saw them, that didn't follow all the other laws. But they would have considered them sinners. But there were also just people that in general society considered sinners. Even if you weren't a Pharisee, you would look at people and say, he's not the best of people. That's kind of a wicked person. People who just disregarded the law. So they ask the disciples this, but Jesus is the one who answers them. Now, if he's inside at this feast, and they're somehow talking to the disciple, how does he end up answering them? We don't know. This whole thing might be parenthetic, just that we're told he went and sat down, and Luke might just be referring now to something that happened at another time. There was this other time where Pharisees were questioning why he would do something like this, and this was Jesus' response. And Jesus answering said unto them, they that are whole need not a physician, but they that are sick. I come not to call the righteous, but sinners to repentance. He's going to use a lot of metaphors in his answers in these questions. And this time he compares himself to a physician. People who are well, people who are whole, don't need doctors. Why would I go to people who don't need a doctor? And then he applies that physician metaphor in verse 32. I didn't come to call righteous people, but sinners to repentance. First of all, he's saying that he's coming to eat with these people. Why?
Because they need salvation.
Okay. It's not just that he's coming to be buddies with them. I just want to get to know them and be their friend. I'm here to call them to repentance. And I can't call them to repentance if I don't talk to them. If I don't spend time with them, how can I talk to them about repenting? I mean, I could stand on a street corner and yell at them. That's probably not going to do a lot of good. So he's eating with them. And he says that that's what I'm doing. And later on, he's going to say that that's what we're supposed to do. And in 14:13, we'll just look there. We'll start actually with verse 12. Then he said also to him that bade him, when thou makest a dinner or a supper, call not thy friends, nor thy brethren, nor thy kinsmen, nor thy rich neighbors, lest they also bid thee again, and a recompense be made unto thee. But when thou makest a feast, call the poor, the maimed, the lame, and the blind, and thou shalt be blessed, for they cannot recompense thee. He's telling his disciples the same thing. It's very easy, and this is really easy for us today, to kind of self-ghettoize, to become a ghetto of, you know, we're us, and we stick together, we eat together, we spend our time together, and then there's those people out there, and, well, I hope that they come and join us, but we're not going out there with them, because we don't want to be tainted. And Jesus says, no, don't do that. Quit making yourselves into some kind of self-contained ghetto. Call other people in. Call the lame and the blind and the poor. Bring them in. Don't just sit around as a big clique and you know, enjoy being righteous together. You've got to go out and meet sinners, or you can't contact them and call them to repentance. Then in verse 33, they said unto him, okay, who are they? All right. That would seem most likely in the flow of the story, except they're going to refer to themselves in the third person here in a moment, which would sound odd. And it could be that this little thing we had, the vignette about why do you eat with sinners, was a parenthetical statement that was something that happened another time that Luke is just putting here to explain the problems that this caused, that he would eat with someone like Levi. And that verse 33 is actually what happened at the dinner party. That it's the guests who are asking this, not the Pharisees. Because it's not a particularly hostile question. It's just a question. They said unto him, why do the disciples of John fast often and make prayers, and likewise the disciples of the Pharisees, but dine and eat and drink? John's disciples pray and fast often, and the Pharisees' disciples do the same thing. But yours don't do that. Yours eat and drink. Obviously, everybody eats and drinks, so I'm not condemning them for eating and drinking. But why don't you take some time to fast? Why always eating? Why not fasting? Now, what was the purpose of fasting? Is fasting something you associate with when times are really good? You know, everything's going great, so I think I'll fast. Generally, in the Old Testament and elsewhere, it's associated with times of trouble and crisis, and when things are not going right, that people would fast. You know, that was what fasting's primary symbolism was, that there's something wrong, and they're calling upon God. And Jesus said unto them, can ye make the children of the bride chamber fast while the bridegroom is with them? But the days will come when the bridegroom shall be taken away from them, and then they shall fast in those days. The bridal party, are they going to fast at the wedding? Are they going to say, oh, at the wedding, kind of fast? No. As a matter of fact, even the Pharisees wouldn't do this. You know, the Pharisees had rules that you had to fast on 2 days a week. But if that fell on a feast day, or it fell on a wedding, or some other event that was supposed to be joyous, they wouldn't fast. They would make an exception for that day. There's joyous times that even you wouldn't fast. Nobody would fast, you know, a symbolism of dissatisfaction and something being wrong on a joyous day like that. And so he says, but the day is going to come when the bridegroom will be taken away, and then they'll fast. When the bridegroom is no longer there, when the joyous time is over, then there will be fasting. What is he talking? Now here he doesn't really explain the metaphor. He just says, you don't fast when the bridegroom is here. When he's gone, you can fast. What is he talking about? Okay, yeah, more than likely saying, you know, while I'm here with them, this is a time of great joy and great ministry, and there is nothing to fast about right now. The time will come when there will be a call for fasting. And then very quickly, I really want to get through this. In verse 36, famous set of parables here, he spake also a parable unto them. No man putteth a piece of new garment upon an old, if otherwise then both the new maketh a rent, and the piece that was taken out of the new agreeth not with the old. Now, somehow, this parable is related to what just happened. He was asked this question, why don't you fast? Why do you eat with these people? So everything in this section has to do with eating. Why are you eating with these people? And then why are you eating at all? These answers have to do with it. These parables in some way relate to what he was just saying. Nobody puts a piece of a new garment upon an old. So you have an old garment that has a tear, a hole, a rip, something, and you need to repair it. Nobody is going to take part of a new piece of cloth and stick it on there, because when it shrinks, it's going to make the tear worse, and they're not going to match. So what is that saying? And this is often read as, you know, the new garment is the good one. You don't want to hurt it. You know, the old one should go away. We tend to privilege the new and reject the old. If he's actually doing the opposite, the old is obviously worth saving. He's trying to do something to repair it. It's not being rejected. The old is good. As a matter of fact, he's going to end this by saying that. And because it's the New Testament and the Old Testament, we tend to think of, well, the new must be Jesus being new, and the old must be the Old Testament, the old ways. We see those two words, new and old, and automatically categorize them in a certain way. But clearly here, the goal is to repair the old garment. The old garment is good. Fix it. But don't do it in this way. Don't just try to slap something new on it and say, there it is, it's fixed. That won't work. And then when the next metaphor, no man putteth new wine into old bottles, else the new wine will burst the bottles and be spilled, and the bottle shall perish. You're making new wine, you need to store it. Don't put it in an old bottle. Why? Because the bottles will break. And the old bottles are good. Again, this is not rejecting the old bottles as bad and the new wine as good. It's saying you don't put it in there because you don't want to damage the old bottles. It would be a bad thing for them to perish. And, of course, the new wine perishes too. Everything is destroyed when you try to mix these two together. But you put the new wine in new bottles and everything's fine. Then in the last sentence, only Luke includes this sentence from this incident. No man also, having drunk old wine, straightway desireth the new, for he saith, the old is better. I think sometimes as fundamentalist Christians with not a lot of experience with wine, most of us, forget that old is better with wine. New wine is not good. It's the old wine that's the good wine. People won't drink new wine and say, wow, that's good. No, old is better. So the preservation of the old is the best thing, the preservation of the old garment. I think that he's saying the opposite sometimes, what we say here. And it would be hard to imagine Luke saying that Jesus is the representative of something new. Because the whole book up to this point is that this is old. This goes way back to Abraham. This is God's plan from the very beginning. He's just the fulfillment of that. His first sermon in the synagogue was, you know, I'm the fulfillment of this. The old prophecies are now coming true. This isn't anything new. What's new? He's not new. What's new? The Pharisees are the ones who are new. They're the ones who have come along in the last 100 years and said, you know, we need to improve on the Old Testament. You know, all this stuff that's about the priests have to live a certain way, everybody should live that way. So they demanded priestly purity out of everybody. Basically, their new way of doing things, their new righteousness that was better than the old one. I think Luke is, or what Jesus is doing, is saying, you know, I'm the old way, you're the new way, and this, you need to do things in fulfillment of God's plan, not make up your own new plan to try to patch up that you think is wrong with the old one.